Blog Talk Radio.
Mojuba Asheda, Mojuba Aluwa Mi, Apolabi Pega, Mojuba Araba Mi, Adesanya Awuyade, Mojuba Ogute Compound Ode Remo, Mojuba Baba, Mojuba Yeye, Mojuba Egun, to all the God children, Mojuba Egun, to all the Babalawos, the Ears, Mojuba Egungun, to all the chiefs, Mojuba Egungun, to all the Awos, Mojuba Egungun, to all those that are listening, who are tuned in. We give praise and thanks to the Most High. We say Ashe, 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 Ashe,
Ashe-o.
Ashe-o. Welcome to Sign of the Times, everyone. This is Queen Tahira. Sign of the Times is brought to you by the UAC and New Power Radio Network. We began the UAC after the unjust Zimmerman verdict of July 2013, and we invite you to please support our sponsors, Manhood, Race, and Culture, headed up by my co-host on Wednesday nights, Dr. James Jones. You can find him as James Jones on Facebook and Manhood, Race, and Culture as a group and like page and on the World Wide Web at manhoodraceculture.com. Also, please support Unity Design, headed up by Arlie Gordon out of Detroit. Find him on Facebook as Arlie Gordon, Unity Design, and on the World Wide Web at unitydesign.com. And again, Unity is spelled U-N-I-T-E-E. And, of course, we never want to forget our brothers and sisters who are behind enemy lines. Please support Unheard Voices, the Free Alabama Movement, and the Free Ohio Movement, respectively, on Facebook, as well as the World Wide Web at freealabamamovement.com and freeohiomovement.org. So tonight we're going to continue our Listen and Learn session, and we're focusing on political prisoners tonight, and I don't know how long this broadcast tonight is going to go. I'm having some technical difficulties in my studio, having just relocated and things like that, so I'm going to rock this thing out as long as the studio will allow me to, but we will be live here tomorrow night at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time with our beloved sister Andreon Tucker, Andreon's Holistic Health and Healing, and tomorrow we're going to continue our discussion on post-traumatic stress. Last week we talked about on Friday that our prisoners of war, brothers and sisters who are behind enemy lines, do suffer from a certain amount of physical, spiritual health issues that relate directly to them being held captive. And so as we work through supporting them, as we work through being here for them, as we work through them returning home and getting through the time that they are behind enemy lines, we need to be as whole and as healthy as possible in that as possible. So we had a really good discussion last week about post-traumatic stress syndrome. And this week we're going to be talking about post-traumatic slave syndrome and some of the things that we can do to be healing and what we need to make sure that we spend our energy on as we progress through the process of it all. So tomorrow night, as always, on Friday, we'll be blessed to have Sister Andreon join us and continue our discussion as we continue this healing process. So this is Queen Tahira. As always, I love you. I thank you. I appreciate you, but most of all, I respect you. And we're looking forward to continuing to build and unite as we go along. So hang out with us for a little bit. This first piece deals with the Second Amendment and the fact that white supremacy has influenced the Second Amendment, which was one of the pieces I was going to play last night that didn't get to play. But and then we'll go straight into the dialogue, listen and learn session about political prisoners. So thank you, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow night live here on Sign of the Times at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 5 p.m. Central, and 3 p.m. Pacific. Tell a friend where you've been, y'all, because we're strongest together. Please help us spread the message of the importance of the communal conversations that we are having here on Sign of the Times. So we'll see you all tomorrow night live. Enjoy the listening, everybody. Salute.
I'm Amy Goodman. President Obama speaking in Dallas today at a memorial service for the five Dallas police officers killed by a sniper Thursday evening. Dallas authorities said the sniper, Micah Johnson, managed to amass a personal arsenal, including a semi-automatic SKS rifle, bomb-making materials, bulletproof vests, and ammunition. Over the weekend, President Obama warned the easy access to guns nationwide has exacerbated divisions between the police and local communities.
Part of what's creating tensions between communities and the police is the fact that police have a really difficult time in communities where they know guns are everywhere.
President Obama also addressed the fatal police shooting in Falcon Heights, Minnesota, where an officer shot Philando Castile during a traffic stop for a broken taillight. The aftermath of Castile's death was live streamed on Facebook by his girlfriend while she was next to him in the car with a police officer pointing a gun at her and her four-year-old daughter.
In Minneapolis, we don't know yet what happened, but we do know that there was a gun in the car that apparently was licensed, but it caused, in some fashion, those tragic events. So no, we can't just ignore that and pretend that that's somehow political or the president is pushing his policy agenda. It is a contributing factor. Not the sole factor, but a contributing factor to the broader tensions that arise between police and the communities where they serve. And so we have to talk about that.
Joining us now is historian Gerald Horn, who's looked at the history of the Second Amendment from the founding of the Ku Klux Klan to the Black Panthers. He's author of two new books, The Counterrevolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America, as well as the book Race to Revolution, the U.S. and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow. He's professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Gerald. Can you start off by talking about this past week? From the killings of black men to the killings of the police officers in Dallas?
Well, we should not see these events as terribly surprising. First of all, you have a society that, as President Obama noted, is awash in weapons. Second of all, we have unresolved issues of racism and inadequate discussion about the legacy of slavery and Jim Crow that helps to contribute to a situation where black people are perceived as criminals by the police authorities, which inevitably leads to their slaughter, as you saw in Louisiana and in Minnesota most recently.
I wanted to ask you about that scene of the protesters in Dallas, where you had some 20 of them carrying, military rifles like AR-15s. Yes, you know, in the anti-police brutality rally. Now, this is legal in Texas. During the Dallas attack, police circulated a photo on Twitter identifying an African-American protester carrying a weapon as a shooting suspect. The man, named Mark Hughes, turned himself into police and was released after being detained and questioned for hours. His lawyer has said he's since received hundreds of death threats. He said later, quote, "I can't believe it. The crazy thing about it is, with hindsight, I could easily have been shot," he said. After the Dallas attack, the Dallas mayor, Mike Rawlings, said he supported increased gun control, saying there should be some way to say I shouldn't be bringing my shotgun to a Mavericks game or to a protest because something crazy should happen. I just want to come back to common sense, the mayor said. Now, Ohio also has open carry laws. The RNC is set to begin in Cleveland next week. Talk about the history of gun control from the Ku Klux Klan to the Black Panthers and when it was really put into effect.
Well, first of all, you need to understand that the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which is the calling card for the gun lobby in Washington, D.C., has everything to do with slavery. When the Second Amendment speaks of militias and speaks and also of guns, they're expressing a fear of slave revolts. The Second Amendment did not apply to enslaved Africans. The Second Amendment did not apply to the indigenous population. In fact, it could be considered a capital offense to sell weapons to the Native American population, since the European settlers were seeking to take their land. Likewise, with regard to the Reconstruction era, post-1865, one of the signal reasons that the Ku Klux Klan was organized was precisely to disarm newly freed enslaved Africans. That is to say that the Second Amendment did not necessarily apply to black people in the post-Civil War era. And in fact, their Second Amendment rights were basically eliminated. Similarly, if you fast forward to the 1960s, even the NRA and the gun lobby sought to push for gun reform after the specter of the Black Panther Party marching to the California legislature with arms in hand helped to outrage and inflame political sentiment, including the political sentiment of then-Governor Ronald Wilson Reagan of the state of California. So you cannot disconnect the history of the Second Amendment from the history of racism and white supremacy.
Explain that scene in Sacramento. Explain exactly what went down when you have the Republican governor at the time, Ronald Reagan, taking on, really, gun control, his reaction to Black Panthers being legally allowed to have guns, and they marched on the Capitol in Sacramento of California.
Well, as you know, the Black Panther Party, which in Oakland, California at least, was organized in 1966, had as part of its mantra, as part of its principle, to confront the authorities around the question of police brutality and police misconduct and police terrorism. As a result, they marched on Sacramento, California, seeking reform in that regard. And of course, it caused inflamed sentiments to ensue.
I wanted to ask you about Philando Castile and the calls for the NRA to speak out in his case. He said, his girlfriend said, he had a license to carry. He told the officer that. What about this?
Well, apparently, it has caused internal disruption within the National Rifle Association that the NRA has been relatively mute about the fact that Mr. Castile apparently had a permit to carry a weapon, and yet he was shot by an officer of the state. One can easily imagine that if Philando Castile had not been black, if he had been white, for example, there would have been outrage expressed by the NRA. This helps to solidify the point that I've been making, which is that you cannot disconnect the history of the Second Amendment and lobbying for it from the history of white supremacy.
Talk more about the Ku Klux Klan, historian Gerald Horn.
Well, the Ku Klux Klan not only was a terrorist organization that was formed after the U.S. Civil War to deprive, in the first place, black people of the right to vote. But keep in mind that it had a second iteration in the post-World War I era, about 100 years ago, and in fact, controlled many state houses, and in fact, marched in the tens of thousands on Washington, D.C. It was a popular, mass-based organization, and I dare say that the sentiment that the Ku Klux Klan expressed about a century ago has yet to be extirpated from this society.
As you look at what's happening today, President Obama in Dallas, you teach at the University of Houston, then apparently going to be holding a summit that's going to, that supposedly, not clear who exactly will be included in that summit, but dealing with all the issues here, the killing of the police and also issues of police brutality. What do you think needs to happen?
Well, first of all, we need to support Black Lives Matter, which is under assault right now. As you probably know, there is a petition on the White House website that's garnered tens of thousands of signatures that calls for the United States to determine that BLM is a terrorist organization. I'm sure you're familiar with the defamatory remarks made by former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani against BLM. I think that not only does this organization need support domestically, but it needs support internationally, because if you look at the history of radical reform with regard to what is antiseptically referred to as race relations, oftentimes it's needed an external shock from the international community in order for that reform to go forward.
The Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg said in the Times on Monday, the New York Times, that Heller, the 2008 decision establishing an individual's right to own guns, was a very bad decision. What do you think is the best approach to gun control?
Well, I think that all of us would be well advised to look at the legislation that Governor Jerry Brown of California signed a few days ago, which, among other things, calls for background checks with regard to obtaining ammunition. The Second Amendment does not speak to the question of ammunition, and I think that that's a loophole that we should try to drive a truck through. We should also look into background checks generally. And in fact, on the California ballot in November, as of now, there will be Proposition 63, sponsored by Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom, that tends to go beyond the legislation that Jerry Brown authored. I think that activists in locales across the nation need to push this kind of statewide reform with regard to gun control, because seemingly the Republican right wing in Washington, D.C. will be blocking gun control on the federal and national level.
Finally, those who criticized President Obama, saying his refusal to criticize the Black Lives Matter movement led to the killing of the cops, your response?
That's obviously poppycock. I mean, President Obama is under a lot of criticism and a lot of pressure from the right wing to distance himself from Black Lives Matter. That would be like distancing himself from his own children. I think that he should be pressured instead to give support to Black Lives Matter because they are the hope for the future.
Historian Gerald Horn, I want to thank you for being with us. Among the books, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome, everyone, back to the Real News Network. I'm Jared Ball here in Baltimore. Joining us once again, all political prisoners. Welcome, everyone, back to the Real News Network. I'm Jared Ball here in Baltimore. Joining us once again for Facing Reality and our weekly look at the specific crisis of political imprisonment is Jihad Abdul-Mumit. Jihad was himself a political prisoner as a result of his work with the Black Panther Party and Black Liberation Army, and works now as co-coordinator of the National Jericho Movement, whose mission is the freedom of all political prisoners. Welcome back to the Real News, Jihad.
Welcome. Thank you, Brother Jared. Peace and blessings to the listening audience.
So you have some updates and clarifications for us on some political prisoners, including Mutulu Shakur and several others. Could you please update us? Because I know there was a lot of confusion going around over these last couple of weeks around his case and the status of several other political prisoners.
Yes, indeed. So Dr. Mutulu Shakur, he himself, along with the hundreds of other supporters around the world, were anticipating with a lot of joy and excitement of him being released on February the 10th last month, which he wasn't. And so the situation is now that he's been referred to the parole board. And what is really being asked of everybody, all his supporters and the community at large, is to give him that support, that much needed support, so that actually he does not get denied his parole. He's going up on April the 4th, I believe. So if you go to the website, Mutulu is welcome here. Mutulu is welcome here, and indeed he is welcome here. Wherever we reside, he is welcome here. And that website would give you specific detailed instructions about how to render the most focused support that we can give him in terms of writing and calling the parole board. And what Mutulu is really asking is that we give good narratives about his accomplishments and how he has progressively and positively impacted the lives, our lives, and the lives of our youth coming up, and all the things that he has done to advance the cause of freedom and self-determination and a better way of life, human rights for everybody. So that, again, that website is Mutulu is welcome here, because what is happening is that we anticipate the parole board to paint the negative narrative, which we are constantly fighting against, to show that we're showing the valor and the conditions that necessitated our freedom fighters to take the positions that they have taken in the past. And the parole board and those that on that side of the defense, if you will, for lack of a better term, are painting the narrative that he's a danger to society. A danger to society. What society? Who? So we really have to challenge and combat that narrative. And the best way to do that is go to that.
And I know that the parole board was not so kind recently to Sundiata Okoli. Could you first, if you would, recap for our audience who Sundiata is and why he's locked up, and then tell us if that narrative that you were just describing played a role in his recent denial of parole.
Exactly the same condition. So our comrade brother, our dear brother, Sundiata Okoli was Sister Asad Shakur's rap partner. So back in 1973 on the New Jersey Turnpike, there was a shootout interaction with the New Jersey State Police, where one state trooper was killed. And they were charged with that homicide. Brother Zaid Malik Shakur, the third of the three that was in the vehicle, was shot to death, killed by the police. Asada Shakur herself escaped in November 2nd, 1979. And Sundiata, he's been in prison now for 42 years. He's well served the time, even if you look at it as a crime, you know, for that offense, that alleged offense. And so the same situation there, the appellate court ordered his release over a year ago. The government appealed that, and now to the Supreme Court. Now the Supreme Court remanded him back, meaning sent him back for the whole entire parole process. And we fear the same situation as with Dr. Mutulu Shakur. So once again, I'm going to Sundiata Okoli's website. Just Google his name and show you specific ways that you can support him. His lawyers are now trying to establish a parole hearing so he can go and have this opportunity to be free. It's very important that if we talk about support, not just lip service of our freedom fighters, those that have fought for us to be where we are today. We really need to kick it in and support them. So Mutulu Sokor, Mutulu's welcome here. Sundiata Kohli's website, just Google his name. There are also some other prisoners, political prisoners going up this year. Herman Bell's going up this month. He's a New York political prison part of New York 3, Black Panther Party member, as well as Jahlil Abdul-Mutakim and a brother by the name of Robert Seth Hayes, who has a lot of medical issues also. Robert Seth Hayes, Jahlil Abdul-Mutakim, Herman Bell, all these names, you can access them on the JerichoMovement.com website or by their names individually, because these brothers, as with Mutulu and Sundiata, they have their own defense committee.
Well, Jihad Abdul Al-Mumit, we thank you very much again for joining us here at the Real News Network and for keeping us abreast of all these latest occurrences with political prisoners. We greatly appreciate you taking the time.
And likewise, Brother Jared, thank you for the opportunity to present the information to our sisters and brothers in the communities. Thank you. Peace.
And thanks to all of you out there, wherever you are. Again, for all involved, I'm Jared Ball here in Baltimore, saying, as Fred Hampton used to say, to you we say peace if you're willing to fight for it. So peace, everybody, and we'll catch you in the whirlwind.
Battle for the soul of America. I believe that it's a battle that says that what kind of country are we going to be now? Are we going to be one that listens to Latinos, Asians, African Americans, Native Americans, gays, lesbians? Or are we going to be a country that is authoritarian, homogeneous?
A political prisoner is one who, for the most part, is incarcerated because of his or her political beliefs and some type of action that is in opposition to the United States government. We define a prisoner of war as an individual who is a member of a nation or a citizen of a nation who is struggling for national liberation against U.S. imperialism, for example, Native Americans or Puerto Ricans or New African Independence Movement, and who engages the enemy in some armed military action. And for the most part, they are part of the military clandestine formation. And therefore, when they get captured, in most cases, they take the position that they're prisoners of war who are captured in a battle for national liberation.
This is American justice.
That's right.
This is American democracy.
Yeah.
And those of you who are familiar with it, know that in America, democracy is hypocrisy.
That's right.
Now, if I'm wrong, put me in jail.
Right.
But if you can't prove that if democracy is not hypocrisy, then don't put your hands on me.
Right.
Democracy is hypocrisy.
Right.
If democracy means freedom, why aren't our people free?
Right.
If democracy means justice, why don't we have justice?
Right.
If democracy means equality, why don't we have equality?
Black people should understand that the New African Independence Movement is not new. New Africa, the term New Africa is new, but the struggle for self-determination and the struggle for independence on these shores is a struggle as old as the slavery that
Minister Malcolm, I'd like to know why you place so much emphasis on calling the freedom struggle among Afro-Americans in this country a struggle for human rights rather than civil rights.
Well, most of our people don't even know the meaning of civil rights. And by not knowing what it is they're actually trying to get, it has eluded us for the past 100 years. Civil rights is supposed to mean citizenship. When you have civil rights, you have citizenship. When you have citizenship, you have civil rights. And if the 22 million Afro-Americans were actually citizens of this country, it wouldn't be necessary to pass any kind of additional legislation to include us in the Constitution. If you notice, whenever the people come here from Europe, they can come here from Poland, which is a communist country. They don't need any legislation to make this Polish person a citizen. They don't need any additional civil rights legislation to make the refugees from Hungary who come here citizens. They don't need any additional legislation to make anyone who comes to this country a citizen. But when it comes to the rights of the black people who are the descendants of slaves, then immediately new legislation is necessary. So this right here implies that when the Constitution was written, in some way or other, it must have excluded those of us who were slaves at that time. And because we were excluded from the Constitution when it was originally written, today they have to amend it in order to include us. But if you notice, the Civil War didn't include us in the Constitution. Had the Civil War Constitution, we would be citizens today. Had the amendments even to the Constitution actually included us, we would be citizens today. If the Supreme Court desegregation decision way back in 1954 was sufficient to include us into the jurisdiction of the Constitution, all of our problems would be solved today. So there's something about civil rights that makes it almost impossible for us to get it. So you have to know the difference between civil rights and human rights. As long as our people are begging for civil rights or they are labeling their struggle for freedom, justice, and equality under the label of civil rights, then what they do is leave us in the jurisdiction of Uncle Sam's court. And it's actually Uncle Sam who is guilty of all of the violation of our rights that have taken place in this country. So when you go to Uncle Sam to try and get some kind of redress over civil rights violations, you're taking your case to the man who's responsible for the violation. So the only way our people can really get some meaningful results, it has to be taken out of Uncle Sam's hands and taken into a world court, in the world court that has been set up to listen to the complaints of human rights violations is in the United Nations. Human rights are international, and civil rights come within the jurisdiction of the country where these rights are violated. Some people may wonder why our brothers from Africa and Asia have not spoken out more boldly or without compromise on the injustices that the 22 million Afro-Americans experience in this country. They can't speak out. As long as these injustices are labeled by us as civil rights, then this remains a domestic issue, and none of our people from abroad, because of protocol, can become involved in Uncle Sam's domestic problems. So all the civil rights groups have to do is expand the struggle from civil rights to human rights. And once it is expanded to the level of human rights, then this puts us in the position to charge Uncle Sam with violating the UN Charter on Human Rights. We can take it before the United Nations, and other nations of this earth can then side with us and indict Uncle Sam for the mistreatment of 22 million Afro-Americans. The very fact that the struggle of the black people in South Africa, or I should say the injustices that has been experienced by black people in South Africa has come before the UN, or the injustices experienced by our own people again in Angola has been brought before the UN. Even the oppression of the Hungarians has been brought before the UN.
the plight of the Jews in Soviet Russia, and there's only 3 million of them in Russia, has been brought before the UN. Well, then why hasn't the problem of the 22 million Afro-Americans come before the United Nations? It has not come before them because the leaders of the civil rights struggle don't understand what civil rights actually amount to. When they are mature to the point where they can see that their present struggle has kept them under Uncle Sam's jurisdiction and Uncle Sam is not morally capable of solving this problem, then they will shift it out of the courts of Uncle Sam and take it to the courts of the United Nations on the level of human rights, and we'll get some kind of meaningful results. As long as we keep it at the civil rights level, we alienate the support of our brothers and sisters in Africa and Asia. But when we shift it to the level of human rights, we have the support of billions of black, brown, red, and yellow people from all over this earth behind us.
The United States is a great world power and has in the past exercised a lot of control and power within the United Nations. So how can you expect to wage a successful battle against such a powerful country in a world court?
Well, whenever you believe in what the United States has taught us concerning democracy, which means one voice, one vote, this is good, because in the present world setup, world governmental setup, as is represented by the United Nations, each country there has one vote, which means that no matter how wealthy a nation is, it only has one vote. And no matter how poor a nation is, it still has one vote. So the ballot actually equalizes the poor man and the rich man. Back when the United Nations was set up, it consisted largely of white nations, because most of the dark nations were then colonized and weren't independent. Since the dark nations have gained their independence and have emerged on the scene, today in the UN you have more dark nations who are in a position to vote in a bloc than you have white nations. So that we have a situation now where the grouping together of the dark nations who formerly were colonized has given them enough political power to offset the military power and prestige of these mighty white nations of the West. And it is their support. It is only in the United Nations, where everyone has the ballot, where everyone has equal vote, that the plight of the black man can be given a just hearing and the weight of the dark world can come down on our side and balance the scale on our side. But whenever you take it into the white man's court, you never will get justice, because the white man is the guilty one who committed the crime in the first place. It's like taking your case from the wolf to the fox to take it to Washington, D.C.
I don't think I wholeheartedly go along with that, Mr. Malcolm. I have some appreciation for your discussion as regards to the human right and the civil right. But here in America, as a band of Negroes, I think the most progressive thinking that we could possibly attain is civil rights. This is the thing that we want. This is the thing that we hope to get. This is the thing that we're going out to fight for. Without our civil rights, the human rights, and the rest of the elements are non-entities as far as
human rights come before civil rights. Human
that
rights.
May be so, but the civil rights are an important factor.
You can never get civil rights until you have human rights. Human rights represent the right to be a human being. Whenever you are respected and recognized as a human being, your civil rights are automatic.
But if we get civil rights, we are human beings.
No, you have to get the recognition of human rights first. This is why people can come here from Africa and Asia and immediately are able to benefit from what the Constitution stands for, because they are recognized as a human being when they touch the shores of North America. But the black people in this country, all of our human characteristics were destroyed by slavery. Our language was destroyed. Our history was destroyed. Our culture was destroyed. And then the white man taught us that we were savages in the jungle and living at a subhuman level. And for this reason, when they put the Constitution together, they classified our people as three-fifths of a man, which meant subhuman, not a complete human being. And once our human characteristics were completely destroyed, this gave them justification for treating us like we were animals. And it also justified their selling us from plantation to plantation like you sell a horse and a cow and a bag of wheat. Why, George Washington himself, historically, is on record as having sold or having traded a black man for a keg of molasses, which shows you he didn't regard that black man as a human being. If the black man's human rights had been respected, he never could have been a slave here in America. And if his human rights had been restored by the Emancipation Proclamation, automatically we would have been citizens right after the Civil War. So we must be regarded as humans,
our human rights must be respected before we can ever be regarded as citizens and our civil rights be respected.
When you have a government that operates without limits, which proclaims the right to arrest, torture, and kill anyone, anywhere, with no warrants, no trial, no due process, when you have a government that militarizes the police and grants the armed forces the power to operate with impunity, within your own borders and beyond, a government that views you, the people, as the enemy, and treats you as such, when you have a government that lies to take you into wars of aggression, toppling country after country, killing countless innocent civilians, sending your sons and daughters, your fathers and brothers home in flag-draped coffins, were disfigured and broken in mind and body, their lives destroyed in wars that serve only to line the pockets of an unelected cartel of bankers and corporations. When you have all of this right in front of you, so blatant, so clear, with president after president towing the line of the same agenda, you shouldn't have to be convinced that both parties in this political puppet show are owned and operated by the same interest. And you shouldn't have to be convinced that these overrated corporate popularity contests that some call elections are distractions that achieve nothing. And if you see where this is headed, you shouldn't have to be convinced that the system that you're living under must be brought to a halt. These are obvious conclusions for those who've been paying attention, so we won't try to convince you here. This video focuses solely on how to bring that system to a halt. Think of it as an instruction manual for a revolution. There are those who will be taken aback when you start using the word revolution. Revolution, the act of revolting and overturning the current power structure, is an extreme measure, one that should be handled with extreme caution, and in most cases, they should be avoided. Revolutions are dangerous in every sense of the word, and it is difficult, if not impossible, to predict their outcome. But there are times when allowing those in control to stay in control is even more dangerous. Right now, the question you need to ask yourself is this: are we at that point yet? Can the current system be reformed? Revolutions begin with a no, and they end with a yes. Revolutions begin when you say no to those who claim to have power over you. And revolutions end when you accept a new status quo, a new normal, whether that new normal is an improvement or not. The causes of revolution are numerous in form, but there is one common root, and that's discontent. Discontent is the emotion that builds and builds under the surface. It is a storm which brews in the mind of the people, just waiting to be unleashed. The trouble is that it's much easier to unleash that storm than it is to get people in agreement as to what should come next. It's not easy to get people to see eye to eye regarding what needs to happen after the current system falls. So this is usually put off, or avoided altogether. And that's a serious mistake. Without clear objectives, chaos usually sets in soon after the old regime falls. And then, in the power vacuum that's created, a tyrant rises to bring order. As a result, the systems that follow revolutions are often just as totalitarian or more totalitarian than those that they replace. It should therefore be abundantly obvious that discontent is not a sufficient driving force for a revolution. That is, if your goal is to actually leave a better world for your children and grandchildren. In order for enough people to have positive results, it must be driven by a clear and realistic vision. A vision that accounts for the world and humans the way that they actually are right now. Not the way that we wish they would be, or that we hope that they might be. And it must differentiate between that which can and cannot be changed in the short term. There is nothing more dangerous than armed men with utopian dreams. So, let's be realistic, shall we? We the people are divided. We have divided ourselves into classes and subclasses, liberals and conservatives, libertarians, anarchists, socialists, anarcho-socialists, minarchists, state-based free market capitalists, anarcho-capitalists, resource-based economy advocates, and more. There is absolutely no chance that any one of you is going to convince all the others that your way is the right way. Unless, of course, one of you rises to political power in the fray and enforces your beliefs by the barrel of a gun. This is the way it usually happens throughout history, and this is what we must avoid repeating. The movement is only successful if it starts with an idea that is strong enough to take root in the mind of the population and inspires and motivates people to spread it. It is possible for a diverse and divided people to form a coalition in times of great need and unify around an idea, but it only works if that idea meets the following three requirements. 1. It must articulate a clear and defined common interest which allow the people to work together. The necessity for unification, even if that unification is temporary, needs to be evident to all stakeholders, and it must be accompanied by a sense of urgency which impels people to reach out to others in their community and spread the idea. 2. A clear vision of what you're working towards. What are you going to replace the current system with? Ironing out the fine details isn't actually productive. What's needed is a broad and abstract vision based on principles. In human societies, extreme and abrupt changes are usually destructive. All efforts must be made to retain social stability. This means steering clear of any sort of utopian fantasies. The time to rewire humanity is not during a period of crisis. Historically, such attempts usually end in tragedy. 3. A plan of action and a clear understanding of the rules of engagement. We'll refer to these three elements collectively as the conscious revolution paradigm. You don't have to get mystical about it. It just means think before you act. Let's start with the common interest. Establishing the common interest is easy if you're informed. And if the people around you aren't informed, then your job is clear. Inform them. Whether you consider yourself a liberal or conservative or none of the above, the bankers and the corporations which hold the puppet strings of the state have placed us all on a path that leads to complete and total destruction. Our common interest is the world that we're leaving our children. The clear vision of what we're working towards is much harder. Again, there's nothing more dangerous than armed men with utopian dreams. And there's no greater symptom of utopianism than the illusion that we can convince the entire world to accept one monolithic belief system. Yet, at the same time, all great movements are driven by an idea. They're driven by a vision. How do we resolve this apparent contradiction? How do we find a common vision without falling for the naive fantasy that we can unify all worldviews? The answer is actually pretty simple. And that's a good thing, because only very simple ideas can be transmitted from person to person without breaking down. Our vision must start with the foundational understanding that there's not one single right way for humans to live on this planet, and that it is unacceptable to force others into any system without their consent, or to use violence or coercion to compel them to obey a set of rules that they never agreed to. That should just be common sense, but it's really not for most people. Most people like to use government thugs to enforce their good intentions. They just don't like it when it comes home to roost and the gun is pointed in their face. When the current system falls, there's going to be no way to reconstitute it in its old shape and size without violence and coercion, and even that probably wouldn't work. Therefore, the only real ethical option is to accept that Humpty Dumpty isn't going to be put back together again. When it's time to rebuild, we don't need to figure out one system that everybody can fit under. Rather, we need to figure out an approach which facilitates multiple systems side by side. What would this look like? Well, imagine a network of small, voluntarily formed communities bound together in loose federations that cooperate for mutual defense and trade as needed, with decision-making taking place at the local level. It's a simple concept, one that's been applied many times throughout history. The most striking example, however, is the Iroquois Federation, which unified 6 tribes, each with their own cultures and traditions. The Iroquois Federation existed before the arrival of Columbus and lasted until 1779 when they were conquered militarily by the U.S. Many historians believe that the Iroquois Federation served as the original inspiration for the United States. The most striking difference being that the Iroquois Federation never had a central government. No one at the top had the power to force the member tribes to do anything whatsoever. And yet, this system worked, and it worked well for a very long time. So clearly this is not a utopian fantasy. It's a viable option, and it's the only option that can be enacted on a voluntary basis. The final element of the conscious revolution paradigm is the plan of action, the strategy and tactics, the short-term and long-term goals, and the structure of the movement. So let's start with the top-level strategy and move towards tactics. Some think of revolution in terms of bullets and bombs, but this is a misconception. Revolutions are about pulling the pillars of power out from underneath the state, one by one, until it falls. The state leans on 3 primary pillars of power. 1, the control of the group mind, ideas, and beliefs. 2, the control of money, finance, and thereby human activity. And 3, the monopoly on violence and the use of intimidation to extract obedience by fear. There are 3 stages of revolution, and they are sequential, and they correlate directly with the 3 pillars of power. The first is the ideological revolution. This is where we undermine the belief systems which support their control. This is where we systematically erode their illusion of legitimacy, their aura of power. We expose these criminals for the scoundrels that they are, and we inspire discontent among those who the state depends on for its functioning. If you're new to this, welcome to the party. It's already in full swing, and guess what? We're winning. The powers that be have lost control of the dialogue, and they know it.
In recent decades, worldwide social change has experienced unprecedented historical acceleration, particularly because instant mass communications, such as radio, television, and the internet, cumulatively have been stimulating a universal awakening of mass political consciousness. The resulting widespread rise in worldwide populist activism is proving inimical to external domination of the kind that prevailed in the age of colonialism and imperialism. persistent and highly motivated populist resistance. Of politically awakened and historically resentful peoples, the external control has proven to be increasingly difficult to suppress.
The second phase of the revolution is strategic noncompliance, or more accurately, defiance. This can take many forms, and multiple approaches can be used at the same time. The goal of strategic noncompliance is to interrupt the chain of obedience for as long as possible, as many times as possible, to publicize that interruption on as large of a scale as possible, to document the police and/or military brutality that follows, and to distribute that footage far and wide. The purpose of this is to damage the ruling party's image, because power is all about image. It's all smoke and mirrors. Once that image starts to break down, this inspires others to disobey. Monkey see, monkey do. And when this catches on and contagion sets in, it becomes a force of nature, like a tidal wave. It's all about reaching critical mass. What's crucial to understand here is that revolutions are almost entirely psychological in nature. In this context, building confidence is the most important element. Therefore, it's better to do small, successful operations and build up from there than it is to start with large, high-stakes events. The third stage of the revolution comes when the people have built up the necessary momentum to take the monopoly on violence out of the hands of the current regime. In the best of circumstances, such a transition can be relatively peaceful. But this is only possible when a significant portion of the police and the military have taken the side of the people. The police and military are the enforcement arm of the state, and without them, the powers that be have no power at all. Faltering governments almost always resort to brutal repression to attempt to stay in power. But this is often a fatal error. Even one refusal to follow an immoral order can set off a chain reaction that destroys the illusion of authority that they so carefully cultivate. Once that happens, it's game over. In East Germany, on November 7, 1989, the Communist Party ordered the military to put a stop to mass protests which had been growing throughout that year. The commander of the army refused, and he ordered his men to stand down. This sent a clear message that the Communist Party was no longer in control. This realization spread quickly through the population, and communism fell. Now, since this is such a crucial element in the equation, it's not something that should be left up to chance. Every effort needs to be made right now to reach out to the police and military, to help them wake up to what's going on, and to let them know that the people will support them if they break the chain of command. Now that we've outlined the big picture, let's look at two other key elements, leadership and organizational structure. Our current system relies on a hierarchical chain of command, a social pyramid which allows a small handful of individuals to control everyone else. In sociology, this is referred to as vertical collectivism. If our long-term vision is not compatible with such a structure, it would be foolish to build a resistance movement which copies it. Ends don't justify the means. The means will determine the end result. So if we want a decentralized, non-hierarchical federation of autonomous communities to replace the current system, the movement must be decentralized and non-hierarchical as well. This doesn't mean that there's no place for leadership. To the contrary, leadership is essential. The distinction needs to be made between leaders and rulers. Leaders walk ahead of the crowd. Rulers place themselves above the crowd. What's needed is a vast network of leaders, independently motivated and capable of thinking for themselves, working to organize groups both locally in the real world and online, unified not by obedience to a single leader, but unified by an idea. Now, while this approach does present some challenges logistically, it has the advantage of making it virtually impossible to destroy the organization merely by getting rid of one or two leaders. A distributed organizational structure is much more resilient. So, where are these leaders? Well, don't wait for them to appear. We need you to be one of those leaders. If you don't know how to be a leader, learn. Dealing with crowds is a skill, one that you can refine through practice and study. Anyone who wants to learn the basic psychology of uprisings and how to work with the public should study the following books intensely, reading them several times, taking notes and reflecting on what they say. Three books, The Crowd and The Psychology of Revolution by Gustave Le Bon, and From Dictatorship to Democracy by Gene Sharp. These books are all available online to read and download for free. You'll find links to these books in the description of this video. Now, a word of warning, these books contain politics, opinions, and prejudices that I did not endorse. Like all books, they should be read with a critical mind, questioning everything that's said. However, they do offer a great deal of insight as to how to take power out of the hands of a tyrant. Leadership takes many forms and can mean many things depending on the situation. However, the primary job of leaders is to inspire people to take action, to organize people into groups so they can be more effective than isolated individuals, and to train others to do the same. Now, the final element you need to start your revolution is tactics. In the realm of violence, the state has a definitive advantage, and it would be foolish to engage them where they are strongest. Instead, we should use tactics that engage them where they are weakest. Fortunately, there's no shortage of nonviolent tactics which have been proven effective in toppling dictatorships. Gene Sharp's book, From Dictatorship to Democracy, lists 198, but those are by no means the only ones that can be used. The tactics employed by each group will depend on the mission and the specific goals of the group. The military divides itself into Army, Air Force, Navy, and Marine so that each can be specialized in the tactics of the terrain where they fight. Likewise, a nonviolent movement should have specialized groups for specific issues. This is already developing. We have PANDA, People Against the NDAA. PANDA is a national organization which has been working to fight the NDAA on a state and local level, and they've been having successes. What's most impressive is that the founder, Daniel Johnson, started this organization when he was 17. Also, there's the Oath Keepers, founded by Stuart Rhodes, which has been reaching out to the police and the military, reminding them of their oath, and preparing them psychologically to disobey when unconstitutional orders are handed down. The Oath Keepers have made a public stand against the NDAA, and they're gaining traction within the ranks. Others are organizing social media teams to collect and spread information. Others organize street activism, such as writing messages in chalk on sidewalks, or hanging up posters, or inserting small leaflets into books and magazines in the store. The possibilities are endless. Whether you start your own group, join an existing group, or act as an individual will depend on your disposition. No one can decide that for you. The most important thing is to take the first step. Start doing something. Anything. Take action and break the inertia of passivity. This is how you take back your power, 1 millimeter at a time. Now, right here, in this 15 minutes, you've been given enough information to start a revolution. You might need to watch this video more than once, and you will need to read those books. But now you have an instruction manual, something you can hand out to people and help them to learn. If you'd like more people to see this video, please share it through as many avenues as possible. Post it on Facebook, Twitter, on your blog, or send it to your friends via email. You have permission to download it, put it on disk, and distribute it on the streets. If you translate it, please post it as a video response so that it's easier for people to find. If you'd like more videos like this, subscribe to Storm Clouds Gathering on YouTube. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/StormCloudsGathering, on Twitter at Collapse Updates. You can find us on Google+ by doing a search for Storm Clouds Gathering, and our website is stormcloudsgathering.com.
Sacrifice. Cuba, a place where the slogan, homeland or death, built a proud new nation. Cuba, home to Assata Shakur and Guillermo Morales, our own freedom fighters. Assata Shakur, previously known as Joanne Chesmar, was held and tortured in the U.S. prison system as a captured member of the Black Liberation Army. Upon her liberation from prison on November 2, 1979, she was granted political asylum in Cuba, where she now resides. William Guillermo Morales, alleged leader of the FALN, was captured, sentenced, and tortured in a U.S. prison in July of 1978. Vowing he would not be in prison long, he escaped and was later recaptured and tortured in Mexico, once again on May 26, 1983. Due to the Mexican people's history of solidarity with the Puerto Rican independence movement and the tremendous international pressure, Guillermo was allowed to fly to Cuba, where he received political asylum. Last year, the Lexington Control Unit for Women, which had three political prisoners in it, was closed down after a District of Columbia judge declared that the prison violated the human rights of the prisoners. Why do you think this brutalization of women in the control units, up to and including rape, is becoming so common?
I think that the brutalization of women, especially women political prisoners, is a result of the fact that women are becoming more active, more vocal, and as women are becoming more active and more vocal, they look to women for leadership. They look to women for examples, and that these women are examples to women who say, I'd like to struggle, and who would look toward a Alejandrina Torres as a role model, as someone they could say, you know, I'd like to be like her. This is a woman who's principled. This is a woman who stands up. They would look to a woman like Susan Rosenberg and say, this woman has taken principled stands against oppression, and I'd like to be like her. And what the government is doing now is setting up prisons that are more and more repressive, trying to set up control units that are more and more repressive, that where they create a situation where you have people living in a state of torture, 24-hour-a-day torture, with no recreation, no human contact, no fresh air, no contact with other human beings, that they do everything in their capability to try to remove that person from a normal human environment. And that it's not, I mean, it's not just imprisonment, it's imprisonment with a vengeance. And I think that we have to really struggle to close down all of these units that are really torture units, and to expose the viciousness with which people are confronted. People, for example, in Marion, you have a bed that's a concrete slab with four rings on it, rings to tie people's hands down and tie their feet down. I mean, that is inhumane under anybody's standards, but that exists. Marion is inhumane under anybody's standards. To keep someone in a cage for 23 and a half hours a day is inhumane under anybody's standards. But that's going on, and that we have to just pool our resources to fight against the Marions, because it's not just one Marion, it's a whole nation of Marions that's cropping up.
Look, there are some people who will say, well, I can support prisoners of conscience, sort of like Amnesty International does. But then they ask, how can I support people like Matulu Shakur or Tommy Manning, who are convicted of killing policemen and who have used violence and bombed things? How can I support that?
I have to understand that the American system, the American capitalist system, as we know it, is built on violence. And all types of violence, from sexual violence to racial violence and economic violence, okay? The American justice system is a violent organization. We just have to look at the American jail system and see how violent the American judicial system is. The American economic system is violent. What happens when workers go on strike? Don't they use the police against workers to beat their heads in and make them go back to work and break those strikes, then go back and keep making millions of dollars worth of profits for the American capitalist system? What happened in 68? Didn't they assassinate a peace-loving man like Martin Luther King? He's a man who only marched. He never threw a bomb. He never used a gun. And he was assassinated. Why? Because he got to a point that he represented the conscience, not only of Black America. He was becoming the conscience of all those who are being oppressed within the United States, including whites. And they had to get rid of him, and then he was assassinated. And what I'm saying is that all these actions that have been taken, that have been well carried out by guerrilla groups and armed groups and organizations, is justified within that context. Not only that, international law gives us that right to fight against colonialism and to fight against injustice. And they have to understand, whatever step they take in the name of justice, the United States will take steps to create that injustice and to keep that injustice that still exists.
Recently, in February, Nelson Mandela was released and welcomed by millions of people in the United States as a political prisoner who had spent about 26 years in prison. In the United States, we have political prisoners who have spent up to 20 years in prison. Why do you think it is that people can support the Nelson Mandelas outside of the United States, but cannot or will not support freedom fighters inside the United States?
You have a lot of people within the United States that support popular causes outside the United States. Okay? That is positive. I'm not knocking it. It's good that they support causes outside the United States. But many of these people refuse to support causes within the United States because they are simply afraid, or simply they still carry that racist character that they have. Okay, it's popular, it's cliche, it's in fashion to support, let's say, like you say, Mandela, Nicaragua, El Salvador.
The question, the reason that people will support a Nelson Mandela is because there's been a whole movement in South Africa, a whole movement that's been building, that's been talking about political prisoners, that's been insisting on the legitimacy of that movement, that's been insisting on the liberation of political prisoners, and insisting that the government is the criminal and not those who are fighting against the criminal policies of that government. And we have to do the same thing, because our movement was virtually destroyed on many levels in the 1970s as a result of government repression. The government criminalized our movement in the same way that the government is criminalizing our people, is saying that, you know, for example, in the 1960s, the Black Panther Party was portrayed by the media as these crazy criminals, these kind of anarchistic black folks that were just wild and crazy, and that, I mean, there was never a balanced picture in terms of what the Black Panther Party was about, so that what people every day saw was these crazy Panthers with guns, and that was the image, that you have a Panther, you have a gun, and you have a criminal element. And as time went by, those Panthers were accused of, in many instances, crimes which they were innocent of. They were framed, they were sent to prison for either conspiracy cases, for false, just trumped up criminal charges, and off the face of the earth, out of the movement, out of the center of struggle. And the movement was, you know, the leaders were just chipped away head by head. I mean, they just knocked people's heads off in one way, literally, in the case of Fred Hampton, Mark Clark, or they put people behind bars, and it weakened our movement, but it also criminalized our movement.
There are some prisoners like Sekou Odinga, Tim Blunt, Lusundi Adekoli, who are constantly in places like Marion, who are put into the box, often denied visits, unable to touch their children or wives. But yet these prisoners keep their spirits. They write out articles and messages on an ongoing basis. Where forth comes this strength, this tenacity, if you will?
The U.S. government knew what they were doing when they put Sundi Adekoli into prison. They knew what they were doing when they put Sekou Odinga in prison. They knew what they were doing when they put Sylvia Baraldini in prison, because they were taking some of our most dedicated, some of our most committed, some of our most intense revolutionaries from our midst and locking them up so that they cannot do the work that needs to be done. In the case of Sundiata, we were on trials together. I mean, his humanness, his decency, his calm, his kind of love kept me together. I mean, and through all the time that I've known Sundiata, you know, all that beauty has always shined through. I mean, you know, he's always managed a way to give. I mean, you know, lawyers would come in and tell him their problems, you know, and he would always give advice, show his concern, ask about their kids, ask about, you know, just the day-to-day problems that they had.
What are some of the major cases that you think we need to work on?
In the case of Geronimo Pratt, Geronimo's been in prison about 20 years, and in Geronimo's case, it's ludicrous. I mean, it's absolutely ludicrous. The fact that Geronimo has been in prison 20 years, seven of that 20 years was spent in solitary confinement. Everything was done to break him. Everything was done to destroy him. And that there are government informants, FBI informants, who say that Geronimo was framed, that Geronimo is innocent, that the government itself admits that all kind that number one there was a government agent in his defense team, all this kind of stuff. I mean, so that it's just the fact that he's in prison today speaks to our duty, to our absolute responsibility to struggle on behalf of political prisoners, because you know, I mean, his case is just so blatant, just so obvious. There are mountains and mountains and mountains of documents that prove that he was a victim of COINTELPRO, but the man is still in prison. The case of Mumia Abu-Jamal is a case where the government is trying to kill a revolutionary, trying to literally take his life and put him into the electric chair. And we cannot allow that to happen. We cannot allow that to happen because it's the case of a human being's life, a human being who has struggled, who has dedicated his life to the liberation of his people. But also we cannot allow that to happen because it will set a precedent. And if we do not struggle tooth and nail to keep the state from killing him, then we are allowing a situation to happen where the government can accuse any of us of any crime and put us to death without any mass movement, without even having to take into consideration that there will be hell to pay if you try to kill our revolutionaries. And I think that's really important, because if we allow the government to kill him, we will be sentencing so many of our youth to death. Another case that it is extremely important for people to rally around and support is the case of Alan Berkman. Alan Berkman is only alive because he's a doctor and because he diagnosed himself and insisted on a medical examination. He has Hopkins disease, and his very life is being threatened by the absolute refusal of the prison authorities and the government to provide him with adequate medical treatment. So that is another very important case for people to support.
In 1988, a broad coalition of us came together to form a coalition called Freedom Now, to internationalize the struggle of free political prisoners and prisoners of war. And in December of 1990, there will be a tribunal in New York City in which international jurists will come and raise the question of human rights abuses in the United States. What do you think about this?
Well, I think a tribunal of that sort will be very significant, not only to the struggle inside the United States, but also internationally, because I think that much more needs to be known out here in the world about what is going on in the United States, because the United States government always projects this image in throughout the world that it is a champion of human rights. And the reality of that situation is that the United States is the biggest violator of human rights, not only in the United States, but all over the world.
If this is done, this will create a... I mean, this will be a major victory on an international level. Not only that, I think this can be the basis for more unity within the different third world and progressive organizations in the United States, which is very important, because I also think that there has to be more unity between us. There's been so much disunity that was created by the United States government, okay, with these, all these programs that they created. But I think that working towards the liberation of political prisoners and prisoners of war is also the basis for unity among all these organizations. And not should we be unified to only free our comrades here in jail, but we should be unified towards liberating all of our people that live in the United States also.
You have a situation where there are more than 100 political prisoners and prisoners of war, and so I think that it's really important for people to see that and to understand that these people are in prison because they have struggled, and that it is important to struggle to free them, because they have given their freedom, their time, their sweat, their blood to struggle for the freedom of oppressed people, and that as oppressed people, it is our job to struggle to support them and to struggle for their liberation. And
in the last month, the government of Zimbabwe has offered political refuge status to Mutula Shakur. And then we have you and Guillermo Morales, who have been given political asylum in Cuba. And recently, the Italian parliament has demanded the release and extradition of Silvio Baraldini, according to a U.S.-Italian treaty. What is the significance of these international overtures, and what could be the impact in the international arena?
Well, I think that what this shows is that, you know, there are many governments, especially revolutionary governments, that are not duped by the posturing and the hypocritical stances that the United States government is taking and has historically taken. I think that it's very important that even a government like Italy has been willing to accept Silvio Baraldini as a political prisoner and is offering, you know, for her to go there. What is holding it up, as far as I understand, is the United States government. I think that this is very important, and I think that more and more, as time goes on, many more governments will be willing to accept political prisoners and to take principal positions around political prisoners.